Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the award-winning debut poet Leili Long Soldier. Hailed by Joy Harjo as one of the finest of her generation and revered by poet Maggie Nelson as trenchant and beautiful, Long Soldier has quickly emerged on the literary landscape with her debut collection titled Whereas, after winning the 2016 Whiting Writers Award. No doubt this is going to be an inspiring interview with new rising poet Leili Long Soldier. Stick around. Leili Long Soldier holds a BFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts and an MFA from Bard College. She has served as a contributing editor of Drunken Boat. Her poems have appeared in The American Poet, The American Reader, Kenyon Review Online, and other publications. She's the recipient of the 2015 Native Arts and Cultures Foundation National Artist Fellowship, a 2015 Lannan Literary Fellowship, and a 2016 Whiting Writers Award. She currently lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Leili Long Soldier, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, hi.
Welcome. Where are you calling us from?
Santa Fe, New Mexico.
From Santa Fe. Oh, great. Okay, great. Wonderful. Well, I'm really excited to speak with you about this debut collection of poetry, Whereas. The title is Whereas, published by the very reputable Grey Wolf Press. How does it feel to have your first collection of poetry? You know, have such amazing reviews and support and just to have the book out.
It feels good.
Right, I bet.
A little overwhelming sometimes, only because I think up until now, it feels like I worked very quietly, and I had maybe a poem or two published once or twice a year, so have them all out at once, that's a whole different thing, but overall, it's been really, really wonderful. So
Yeah, I can imagine it feels overwhelming, you know, and that, you know, the poems in here are so very personal and yet also very sort of, you know, I mean, they microscope into the personal and out to the sort of external, you know, and so it's always, I would imagine it could be a scary thing, right? Now, I know, and it got some amazing, I mean, you have amazing blurbs by Joy Harjo and Maggie Nelson and Fred Moten. I mean, like, just some wonderful, and then, you know, I'm also aware that you received the 2015 Lannan Fellowship for Poetry. I mean, you're an awarded, decorated poet, you know, so congratulations just on all the success you've been having.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, as for the book, I'm going to ask you in a minute here to read a poem, but I want to try and describe it for our listeners, and I know that the book itself, on the jacket, it says that it's described as a, quote, text that examines histories and landscapes. And also, as well, your own writing process is part of sort of what's investigated in these poems. But in your own words, how would you describe the book for our listeners?
The book is written, it's in two parts. Mm-hmm. There's a part one and part two. So part one is titled, These Being the Concerns. Mm-hmm. And so those opening poems are sort of poems, I think, that sort of set the foundation for who I am as a writer. So I have a lot of poems that have to do with maybe motherhood or, being a thinker or working academically, also being an artist, and there's poems about process. That's a big part, you know, the reflexive poem, writing on writing. And it's so, I think I do it too much sometimes, but still, so there's those kind of concerns. And also it closes, part one closes with a very long piece called 38, which is a historical piece, you know, it focuses on a piece of our history. And then, so that concludes part one. And then part two, the whole part two is a response to the national apology to Native Americans. And that was signed in December 2009 by President Obama. So that's a series of 28 poems. And all of them are sort of responding to that document. And it's where I get the title for the whole book, which is Whereas, using that congressional language.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I want to get into As we go through the interview, I want to get into some more of that, like in depth, you know, the reflexivity, also the use of this officialness, the language palette that you're pulling from, you know, comes from obviously officialness and, you know, official documents and that, and what have you. And so we'll get more into that depth. I think right now, though, would you mind kicking us off with a poem for our listeners?
Sure.
Great.
Steady summer, solstice, grasses. See, this one's a natural anesthetic, he said. When they fast, they cannot food. Careful water, so slide. Grass, needle tips around the edges of wounds this summer. Potent grass songs, a grass chorus moves. Shh. Through half-propped windows, I swallow. Grass scent, the solstice, makes a mind wide, makes it oceanic blue. A field in crests, swirling gyres, the moving surface fastened in June light. Here I'm certain that certain kinds of talk only equal pain. Excusing myself, I paddle deep in high grass waves. I'm safer outside than in. In those heady grasses, the mouth loosens, confesses. I don't trust nobody but the land, I said. I don't mean present company, of course. You understand. The grasses hear me too, always present, the grasses, confident, grasses, polite, command to shh, shh, listen. At the bottom of trailer steps, grasshoppers power up, plate bodies, jet wings, knock, knock high, speed through a swaying green page, single-spaced, blades, bold, hollow, stems, air, italics. In midday open, two horseflies love buzz, a simple, humid meeting, motorized sex in place, then loose again, infinite circle eights. Shh. Listen. Down the path, ante steps onto the porch. The dog pads across wood planks. A pause to nudge her foot. Shh. In my thoughts, I hear her two states away. Ask for more mac and cheese. This is good, Dad, my favorite. Their forks click in blue gardens, flowered borders, scrubbed secondhand plates. Shh. This grass. Shh. Shh. Who have I become?
Wonderful. And if you're just tuning in, you are listening. That was the voice of Layli Long Soldier reading from her debut collection, award-winning debut collection of poetry titled Whereas. It's out with Grey Wolf Press. You know, and I wanted to start off by reading that, by you having you read that poem, because the grass and grasses later on play a role, especially in the poem Dakota, about the Dakota 38, which we'll get into in a little bit. I don't want us to talk about it just yet, but I think it was a good way to kind of kick this off, because it does play a sort of role throughout building towards that powerful poem about the 38. At the beginning of the book, let's step back a little bit here. At the beginning of the book, you have this wonderful epigraph that actually reads, to me, it was like an instruction to the reader. And it's by the poet Arthur Xie. And it says, quote, "No word has any special hierarchy over any other." Tell us why you felt it was important to start your book with that note.
Well, that quote actually came from class notes. Mm-hmm. It's not published anywhere. Mm-hmm. But I took a class with Arthur at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Mm-hmm. So he was sort of like part of my foundation in writing.
Right.
And one of the people who really helped form and shape how I thought about language and how I thought about the art of writing. And I had one day, this was actually years after I left, I was just going through some old notes. And on the top of a page, I had written, I had that in quotes. And the way I take class notes is if I write things down word for word, I'll put quotes so I know it's exactly the way the professor said it.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
So I was trusting myself that was exactly what he said. And I remember, even though it was years after I had left, I just sat there with that that quote, and I said, my God, that's so beautiful, you know. Mm-hmm. I felt like it, at least for me, the way I internalized it is, it just opened the way for anything, you know. The word, in the English language, let's say, the word soldier has no special hierarchy or, importance over the word trash, right? Mm, yeah. In a poem, it's really how you're working with it, right?
Right, right.
But that also extends into other languages. That is to say, as for Native people or whoever, really even our own Native languages, there's no hierarchy that English may have over our own words. And that was just very, very, I mean, that just opened worlds for me.
Right.
So I felt like that was, to begin the book with that quote, I think that was really a sort of value.
Yeah.
Underlining all of the poems in there.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, when I first opened your book, I received the advanced reader's copy, and when I first opened it, I mean, I was excited to get it. And then when I first opened it and saw that, I didn't just immediately turn pages. I actually sat with that line for a little while. No word has any special hierarchy over any other, and it almost, I mean, it was kind of emotionally moving, you know, that sentence. Mm-hmm. And this is not having read the book yet. This was just on its own, you know, this idea that words. That no word, no single word does have a sort of hierarchy over any other. And therefore, I was allowed to kind of imagine what was contained behind that. You know, I was excited to open and read the poems. And then by the time I got to the end of your book, it really, I think that was just a real shining sort of diamond to put right at the beginning. Just a really excellent move, I think, because you later on through your poems that we'll get into here, you know, utilize sort of governmental language, you know, even the title, whereas, you know, which we find in proclamations often, you know, in these proclamations, whereas this, whereas that, you know, even that. And then you sort of take this governmental language, and then in the context of, you know, Native people and history, you know, it suddenly has so much more meaning when you look at a quote like that. No word has any special hierarchy over any other. It's profound. Now, throughout the book, you know, the language is very reflexive. It does call attention to itself. It calls attention to the form. It calls attention to sort of, it deconstructs itself as it's also writing. It's wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful in that way. It reveals all the inner workings of the poem, and not only of the poem, but of the sort of the narrative. And this is what I loved most. In fact, I kept thinking I'm going to teach. There was one poem in here, I think it was the Dakota 38 poem, that I want to teach it in one of my courses, because it's such a great display of the inner workings of narrative. And also, as it's deconstructing itself, it's creating itself. It's amazing. You know, I don't know how else to explain that. But why was it vital for you to call attention to the language, to reflect back on the poems themselves?
That's a great question, something I'm trying to answer for myself. It's certainly not done for the audience. It is like an impulse, an inner impulse. I always start doing that. And I'm laughing because I had a conversation with a friend, another poet friend named Cedar Saigo, and he is Suquamish from Washington area, and a wonderful poet. But he also tends to do this in some of his work. And so we were talking about that, like, what is it about that? And Cedar was like, I know, what is it? What's up with that? Why am I so compelled to do that? And the two of us were baffled, even at ourselves. Why? Right. What is that? And so I went home, and I was thinking about it and also emailing Cedar about it later. Mm-hmm. And I had this theory, and I thought, I at least for myself, I thought, I wonder if this, I feel like reflecting or thinking about this process of writing is also a way of sort of, okay, it's tapping into that creative place of ourselves, mm-hmm. trying to understand it.
Yeah.
And I think that that creative place is also a great place of mystery. Mm-hmm. It's also a spiritual place, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that I was curious. I was wondering if maybe that's kind of what that's about, at least for me. And maybe for others, I don't know, this trying to unravel or examine and look at what is happening in me, and that, you know, what is that sort of source or that place that right. I'm tapping into?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So I actually, you know, I just tried this theory out, and I sat down with three books of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Cedar's book, uh-huh. and then two other poets. And I said, I'm just going to experiment. And any place I saw them mention the word writing or poem yeah. or anything like that,
right.
I crossed it out, and I couldn't think of... I just tried it. I replaced that with the word prayer,
wow.
just to see if it,
right.
how that would read, if,
wow.
if that was kind of a way of, again, like trying to access that spiritual place.
Wow.
And to be on, and I wanted to see if that's, if by doing that, if there was sort of an equivalence and if I was on the right track, yeah. I will say it didn't work.
It didn't come out the way you imagined it might.
Right. My theory didn't prove correct, right?
Right.
I don't think it was totally on. I wasn't totally on the right track, but I still feel like I'm trying to work that out. And at least in for me, maybe it doesn't apply to other people and other people's books. But mm-hmm. I do think that there is, maybe that's part of what's going on for me, is there's this creative place that is a part of me, but it's not.
Right.
It's still, you know, it's abstract. It's something I cannot see.
Right.
But I can feel it. And so a lot of times I'm trying to understand, how is it that I get there? How does it work? And isn't it funny that it's through line or anaphora mm-hmm. or word choice that somehow I can make that place materialize?
Right.
And I hope that all this doesn't sound weird, but...
No, it's anyway. Not, no. And, you know, I mean, that's the sense I get throughout the book, throughout the collection, is that you're exploring... you know, you're exploring text, and you're exploring its sort of role in your own personal life and in the life of your community, you know. And I know that you're Oglala Lakota, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's exploring sort of yourself and your own, in your community, and you're looking at how language has sort of played a role in that, you know, and then looking to kind of subvert language or reshape it, sort of. You know, I think of Audre Lorde's, we cannot take down the master's house with the master's tools or something like that. That's the quote. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what you do here, though, is it's almost a kind of a challenge to that, I think, because you actually do take the quote unquote master's language, right, the governmental languages, and then you deconstruct them in a way where you sort of create different tools with them. So when we look now at history, like the Dakota 38, which we'll get into right now, when we look at that now through that language that you've deconstructed and created a new tool with, we see it in a new light, in a fresh way. And that's, I just felt very, you know, I thought of that quote right away as I was reading your work. But the Dakota 38, would you kind of break down just briefly what the Dakota 38 is about so we can talk a little bit about that?
So the title of the poem is 38, and it refers to the Dakota 38, which, yeah, you've mentioned. And those are 38 Dakota men who were hanged on December 26, 1862. Mm. And this was the largest mass execution in the United States to date. And they were hanged for what was called the Sioux Uprising at the time. And that was really a revolt of the Dakota people in Minnesota. They were basically starving. And they had signed an agreement that promised them money to buy food. And their hunting rights were limited as well, and they were not getting that money, and they couldn't, you know, they were starving. Right. And so I think maybe like any people around the world, they fought. And so because of this uprising, then many people were imprisoned. 38 men were hanged. And then the Dakota people there in that particular place, they were all moved west, and they lost their land and they lost their territory and everything. So,
and then at one point, circling back to the poem you shared with us, I think it's one of the U.S. cavalry men who say, you know, if they're hungry, let them eat grass.
Right. No, it was a trader.
Oh, it was a trader.
One of the traders of the stores. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem. So they were not receiving the Dakota people were not receiving their money. And then the traders would not extend store credit. And so one of the traders said, if they're hungry, let them eat grass.
Wow. Gosh, this is going so fast. I feel like we're barely even getting going here. Lately.
I know,
I apologize. We're going to have to invite you back on at some point and do an extended interview or something, because, you know, that's one of the things. There's so much history inside of this book. And also, like I said, that history intertwining with even the contemporary, with what we see reflecting today in the world, and also with your own personal life, the way that you maintain this throughout this kind of narrative throughout the entire book, from beginning to right to the very end, to the last notes as well. It's just done wonderfully. It's a tightly written book. How long did you work on this book?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, from the beginning of these poems to now, to publication, how long did that take?
Yeah, that, the earliest poem in here was, I want to say, around 2008 or 2009, the earliest poem was written.
Wow,
so how many years is that?
About seven, 8 years,
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Would you mind then sharing another poem with us and taking us out with a poem?
So this is a piece from the Whereas series. Whereas, my eyes land on the shoreline of, quote, the arrival of Europeans in North America opened a new chapter in the history of Native peoples, quote, end quote. Because in others, I hate the act of laughing when hurt, injured, or in cases of danger. That bitter hiding. My daughter picks up new habits from friends. She'd been running, tripped, slid on knees and palms onto asphalt. They carried her into the kitchen. She just fell. she's bleeding. Deep red streams down her arms and legs, trails on white tile. I looked at her face. A smile quivered her, a laugh, a nervous. Doing as her friends do, she braved new behavior, feigned a grin. I couldn't name it, but I could spot it. Stop, my girl. If you're hurting, cry. Like that, she let it out, a flood from living room to bathroom. Then a soft water pour. I washed carefully, light touch, clean cotton to bandage. I faced her, I reminded, in our home, in our family, we are ourselves, real feelings. Mm. Be true. Yet I'm serious when I say, I laugh reading the phrase, quote, opened a new chapter. I can't help my body. I shake the realization that it took this phrase to show my daughter's quiver isn't new, but a deep practice. Very old. She's watching me.
And that is the voice of poet, award-winning poet, Layli Long Soldier. And she is reading from her debut collection of poetry, Whereas. It's out with Grey Wolf Press. It's just a wonderful collection of poetry. You must pick it up. Thank you so much for interviewing with us.
Yes, you're welcome. And thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
It was enjoyable.
Good. I'm glad. And congratulations on all the wonderful attention this book is getting and on the launch of your career. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you very much.
We'd like to thank our guest today, the amazing debut poet Layli Long Soldier, whose book Whereas is now out with Grey Wolf Press. Be sure to pick that book up. You will not be disappointed. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our wonderful producer, Lauren Terrazas, and I am Tim Hernandez. We'll see you next week, same time, same place, KTEP 88.5 FM.